All right. More representations of God the Father. I like these representations. I like the triangle idea. I mean, I don't know why God is wearing a triangular hat. It's kind of a strange fashion choice, but I think it's associated with the idea of the pyramid, and I think that's associated with the idea of the hierarchy of authority. And I think that's why the Egyptians put their pharaohs inside pyramids. I know there's more to it than that, but I think some of that has to do with the notion of this hierarchical structure. You see this on the... Now, that's speculative, obviously, and I don't want to make too much of it, but I can't help but think that there's something to that. See, that's on the back of the American dollar bill. I like that a lot. That's like the Eye of Horus from the Egyptians. And so the idea here is something like, at the top of the hierarchy is something that is no longer part of the hierarchy. Right? So if you move up the hierarchy enough, what happens is that you develop the ability, as a consequence of moving up that hierarchy, to be detached enough from the hierarchy so you're no longer really part of it, and so that you can move in all sorts of different hierarchies. And the thing, the idea here is that the thing that you're really developing is the capacity to pay attention. And I would say, from a mythological perspective, the one thing that seems to compete with the idea of the spoken word as the source of the extraction of habitable order from chaos is the eye, is the capacity to pay attention. So Marduk, for example, the Mesopotamian creator god, who emerged in the hierarchy of Mesopotamian gods and came out at the top, right? He was the victor of the gods. He had eyes all the way around his head, and he could speak magic words. And I really like that. I really like that idea. And the Egyptians developed that idea too, because their god Horus was the eye. Everyone knows the Eye of Horus. That image is so compelling that we still know about it. Everybody has seen the Eye of Horus with a really open pupil. And what the Egyptians learned was that the open eye was what revivified the dead society. It's so smart. So what do you do if your life isn't in order? Bloody well pay attention. And that isn't the same as thinking. It's a different process. Paying attention, thinking is like the imposition of structure in some sense. I know I'm oversimplifying, but paying attention is something like watching for what you don't know. And so, like, one of the things I often recommend to my clinical clients if they're having trouble with a family member is, number one, shut up. Don't tell them anything about yourself. Just, and I don't mean in a rude way, it's just like no more personal information. Number two, watch them like a hawk and listen. And if you do that long enough, they will tell you exactly what they're up to. And they will also tell you who they think you are. And then you'll be shocked because they think you're something, generally speaking, that's not like you, what you are at all. And when they tell you, it's like a revelation to both of you. But attention is an unbelievably powerful force. And you see this in psychotherapy too, because a lot of what you do, and in any reparative relationship, is really pay attention to the other person. Pay attention and listen. And you would not believe what people will tell you or reveal to you if you watch them as if you want to know, instead of watching them so that you'll have your prejudices reinforced. That's usually how people interact. It's like, I want to keep thinking about you the way I'm thinking about you, and so I'm going to filter out anything that disproves my theory. That's not what I'm talking about at all. It's like, I'm going to watch you and figure out what you're up to. Not in a rude way, none of that. I just want to see what's there. And that'll be good for you, probably, and also be good for me. And so, well, so that's the idea that, you know, climbing up a hierarchy of authority can give you vision, and that vision can transcend the actual hierarchy. And I think that's also that's the metaphysical space that an artist occupies. Because artists really aren't in a hierarchy, they're outside of hierarchies. You've watched The Lion King, most of you? Yeah. That's Zazu, you know, the little bird that's the eye of the king? That's the same thing there. So, and that's echoed in this idea as well. So, that's some more ideas of hierarchies, same idea. This is, right, gold, silver, bronze. Why gold? Gold is the sun. Gold is pure, right? And so the idea is that the thing that's at the top of the hierarchy is incorruptible because gold doesn't mix with anything else, right? It's the sort of metal that doesn't ever become corrupted. It's a noble metal. It doesn't become corrupted. And so it shines like the sun, and it's associated with what's ever at the top of the hierarchy. And the gold medal is a disc, like the sun, and it's awarded to those people who've occupied the top position and who are manifestations of the ideal. And I'll tell you a quick story. So imagine that you're watching an Olympic contest. I found this happens to me very often with gymnastics because the gymnasts are so absolutely unbelievable, you know? So you watch a gymnastic performance, and the person's out there bouncing around like, you know, you can't even imagine doing it. They're so perfect at it. So you see this person, they're going through this routine. They're just absolutely spectacular and flawless at it. You know, at the end, they stop and everybody claps and they're all excited to see what a human being can do. And that's why we're in the audience watching, because we want to see what a human being can do. And the judges go like 9.8, 9.8, 9.8. And everybody's thrilled. And then the next contestant comes out and it's like, well, they're just basically screwed, right? It's like this person came out there and was perfect. How are you going to top that? That's an interesting question, because this is a representation of what you do to top perfection itself. And you can do it. And here's how you do it. And you know this. Even though you don't know, you know it. So let's say the next contestant comes out and they're kind of shaky because it's like, oh man, the bar's being raised high. So what they do is they put themselves right on the edge of chaos. And you can tell by watching them that they are one bloody fraction of a second from catastrophe. They're pushing themselves farther than they've ever gone in the direction of their perfection. And everyone in the room is so tense they can hardly stand it, right? You can hear a pin drop, and that person is flipping around, and they're just, it's just right on the edge of catastrophe. And at the end, they go like this, you know? And there's that gesture that, of triumph that goes along with that. And everybody rises in one instant and just claps like mad. It's like, well, why? What are you doing? What are you doing when you're doing that? Right? You can't even help it. It grabs you right in the core of your being, and you stand up, and it's an act of worship. That's what it is. And you saw someone go beyond their perfection into the domain of chaos and establish order right in front of your eyes. And you're so thrilled about that. You know, you're happy to be alive, and everyone's celebrating it all at the same time. And it's an absolutely amazing thing. And that's what, well, sometimes that's what this represents, and sometimes that's what this represents. And that's what we're trying to get at, that, because that's at the pinnacle of the hierarchy, right? Not only are you doing what you should be doing, but you're doing it in a way that increases the probability that you'll do it better the next time you do it. And then you could say, here's another thing to think about along the same lines. And I know we haven't got to Adam and Eve yet. you tell your kids to play fair, right? You say, it's not whether or not you win, it's how you play the game. And you say that and you don't really know what you mean. You feel kind of stupid saying it even though you know it's true. And your kid looks at you like there's something wrong with you because he doesn't know what you're talking about either. But you know it's true. And so here's why it's true. Life isn't a game. It's a set of games. And the rule is never sacrifice victory across the set of games for victory in one game. Right? And that's what it means to play properly. You want to play so that people keep inviting you to play, because that's how you win, right? You win by being invited to play the largest possible array of games. And the way you do that is by manifesting the fact that you can play in a reciprocal manner every time you play, even if there's victory at stake. And that's what makes you successful across time. And we all know that, and we even tell our kids that, but we don't know that we know it. And so we're not adapting ourselves to the game and victory in the game. We're adapting ourselves to the meta game and victory across the set of all possible games. And that's what that, well, that's exactly what, as far as I can tell, that's exactly what this is aiming at too. That's the same idea, that there's a transcend, there's a mode of being that transcends the particularities of the localized contest. That's the other way to think about it. And to act morally is not to win today's contest at the expense of the rest of possible contests. And again, I don't see that as something that's arbitrary. It's not relativistic. There's an absolute moral stance there, and everyone recognizes it. And I also think it's the key to success. And I would also say it's very much akin in a strange way. Like the person who is the master at being invited to play the largest possible games, number of games, is also the same person. I haven't quite figured out the precise relationship between these two, is also the same person that goes out forthrightly to conquer the unknown before it presents itself as the enemy at the door. They're the same thing. Now, I haven't figured out why that is exactly, but well, I'll figure it out eventually. And when I do, I'll tell you, well, if you're interested. So, okay, so here's some other ideas of God as hierarchical authority figure. So strip the religious preconceptions off what you observe and just look at what you see. Well, look, there's primate looking upward at dominant figure. That's what you see there. Now, It's very interestingly symbolically represented because you have God the Father there with the cross. And I think what that means, as far as I can tell, is that there's a recognition there in the image that the person who's most dominant is the one who's, or the most, has the most authority, is the one who's voluntarily accepted the suffering that's part of being. And that's what that picture represents. It's like the authority holds that and says, this is what you have to accept. And that transfixes the viewer. Because of the fact that it's true. And you think, well, is that true? Okay, well, think about it this way. Do you like brave people or do you like cowards? Well, that's pretty straightforward. And what's the ultimate act of bravery? It's to come to terms with the fact that you're mortal and limited and to live forthrightly regardless. Well, obviously, that's at the core of what's admirable. And why would we presume that that's not the case? We act as if that's the case. It's what everyone dreams and wishes that they could do. I mean, assuming that, you know, you've dispensed with the idea that you're going to be immortal, I suppose that might be worth wishing for too, or perhaps not. Immortal is a very long time. But you certainly want this. And that image says, well, this is what you should be. And, you know, we've got that same opening into the sky going on in that image that I showed you before. It's like this is a transcendent truth that constantly remanifests itself across time and space. And Jung would say, it's built into your psyche, that image. Now, you know, there are elements of it that are culturally constructed. It wouldn't necessarily have to be the cross, although the cross is a very old symbol. It's far older than its use in Christianity, and it's been used in many, many religious representations. But that echoes, the soul echoes with that, you know, and, well, and then there's Moses up there on the mount receiving the law. And so we'll talk a lot more about that when we get to Exodus. But if, yeah. If we get to Exodus. So, well, look, where does it happen? Well, on a mountain. Well, that's a pyramid. That's up, right? That's up. It's up. It's up in the stratosphere. It's up in the sky where you look upward, okay? And then, so what's happening to Moses? Well, here's a bit of a clue, as far as I can tell. I figured this out partly, again, by reading Jean Piaget, because one of the things that Piaget said about kids was that they first learn to play a game, but they don't know what the rules are. Meaning that if you have a bunch of kids together, they can play a game, but if you take one of the kids out of the game when they're young, say six, and you say, what are the rules, they can only sort of give you a representation. So you take six-year-old one, and he'll tell you some of the rules, and six-year-old two will tell you different rules, and you know, six-year-old three will tell you different rules, but if you put them all together, they can play. So they have the knowledge embodied either individually or in the group. The knowledge is there to be extracted. Well, then they get a little older, they can extract the rules, and then they start to play by the rules. And then Piaget's last step was, well, it isn't just that kids play by the rules, it's that they learn that they can make the rules. And he thought about that as moral progression. First you can play, then you can play by the rules. Then you learn, maybe, because he didn't think everyone learned this, that you're actually the master of the rules. That doesn't mean the rules are arbitrary, but it means that you can be the generator of the rules, assuming that you know how to play the game. And he thought about that as a moral progression. And then I thought, well, that's exactly what happened to Moses in the story of Exodus, because Moses is out there leading all those Israelites around, and like, they don't have a law, they don't have a lawgiver, they have a tradition, and they're all like crabby because, well, they're in a desert. It's like they were in a tyranny, but now they're in a desert. It's like, that's no improvement. So they're really getting pretty bitchy about it. And so they're worshiping false idols and having one catastrophe after another, and they get Moses to judge their conflicts. And so he does that for God only knows how long. Forever, crabby Israelites come to Moses and bitch at him. It's like, well, he did this and she did that. And so then he has to figure out how to make peace. And he does that so long that one of his, I think it's his father-in-law, tells him he has to stop doing it because he's going to exhaust himself. Well, then you think, well, what's happening? Well, and I'm not assuming that this is a like a literal historical story. I think, again, it's a condensation. Well, any group has a set of customs, just like a wolf pack does. And so then the customs are being manifest, and someone who's a genius is watching and thinking, okay, well, what's the rule in this situation? What's the rule in this situation? What's the rule in this situation? And then in his imagination, the rules turn into a hierarchy, And then he goes up on the mountain and he goes, bang! And he thinks, oh my God, here's the rules that we've been living by all this time. And that's the revelation of the commandments. Well, and you think, well, how else could it be? You think the rules came first and obeying them came second? It's like, no, the rules come first. Sorry, the actions come first. The obeying them comes first. And then you figure out what everybody's up to and you say, hey, look, this is what you've been up to all along. And everybody goes, oh, yeah, that seems to make sense. And if it didn't, who would follow them? No one is going to follow them if they don't match what's already there. You just think about that as unjust. And so that's portrayed here as a cataclysmic human event. It's like, oh my God, we've been chimpanzees. We've been in this hierarchy of authority for so long. We have no idea what we're doing. And all of a sudden, poof, it burst into revelatory consciousness. And we could say, here is the law. And you say, well, is it given by God? Well, hey, it depends on what you mean by God. We could start with that presupposition, but it's not like it just came out of nowhere. It took a... And this is something else Nietzsche observed so interestingly. And he said, you know, that a moral revelation was the consequence of a tremendously long process of initial construction and then formulation. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years of custom, of building custom, before you get the revelation of the articulated law. And that's a description of the pattern that works. And let's say, well, what's the pattern that works? It's the game that you can play with everybody else day after day with no degeneration. And that's another thing Piaget figured out that's so brilliant, and that's his idea of the equilibrated state. It's an extension of Immanuel Kant's idea about the universal maxim, right? Act in a way so that each action could become a universal rule. That was Kant's fundamental moral maxim, and Piaget put a twist on that. He said, no, that's not exactly it. It's act in such a way that it works for you now and next week and next month and next year and 10 years from now, and so that while it's working for you, it's also working for the people around you and for the broader society. And that's the equilibrated state, and you could think about that as an intimation of the kingdom of the city of God on earth. It's something like that. And it's based on this idea that a morality has to be iterable. And, you know, there's been lots of simulations online already, artificial intelligence simulations of trading games, right? I mean, the people who've been studying the emergence of moral behavior, say, in artificial intelligence systems, have already cottoned on to the idea that one of the crucial elements to the analysis of morality is iterability. You can't play a degenerating game because it degenerates. Like, obviously, you want to play a game that at least remains stable across time. And God, if you could really get your act together, maybe it would slowly get better. And of course, that's what you'd hope for your family, right? That's what you're always trying to do. Unless you're completely hell-bent on revenge and destruction. It's like, is there a way that we can continue to play together that will make playing together even better the next day?